From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
Hurricane Lenny threatens the Caribbean. Fidel Castro resists calls for democratic reform at the Ibero-American summit. And why a low ratio of university-educated people is bad news for the Caribbean. I'm Oren Gordon, and this is BBC Caribbean Report. Hurricane Lenny is threatening the Virgin Islands and neighboring countries while posing something of a reduced threat to Puerto Rico. Islands in the entire chain remain on alert, from Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands in the west to Montserrat in the east. A short while ago, the Lieutenant Governor of Dutch St. Martin announced that Thursday's visit of Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands will be postponed until the island is out of danger. Puerto Rico will be spared the brunt of the 100-mile-an-hour winds. But as reporter Gary Twominen told me, their main concern is torrential rain.
The danger isn't as great as we might have thought, but this is late in the season, and it's moving across the Caribbean from the southwest toward the northeast, a very different motion from a typical peak season hurricane, which normally moves from the southeast to the northwest. But we do expect a lot of rain, as much as 20 inches on already saturated ground. The hurricane is moving continually toward the east on the bottom edge of Puerto Rico, so it'll be a southern and eastern track, and that won't really affect Puerto Rico all that much with heavy winds, but we do expect plenty of rain.
What about the neighboring islands like the U.S. Virgin Islands? How much danger are they in?
They could be in bigger trouble if the hurricane moves toward the north once it passes Puerto Rico, which is quite likely.
And it's to the U.S. Virgin Islands that I went, and reporter Lee Carl of WSTA Radio in St. Thomas. I asked him if they were expecting a big hit.
Yes, we are. The reports to us are that it's moving toward us right now. As a matter of fact, as I speak to you, the first outer rain bands of Hurricane Lenny are moving across us right at this moment.
Give us an idea of the preparations being made there.
Well, today was a busy day for the governor and his staff and VITEMA. That's the Emergency Management Agency. They were making their plans. The governor was on the air at least three or four times urging residents to prepare. I went to at least two or three of the supermarkets, and they were loaded with people buying batteries, foodstuffs, water, mainly water, and they were preparing. A lot of the houses already, interestingly enough, had shutters up from the last go-around and never took them down. Other people were putting back up the plywood boards on the windows. And for the most part, it was so calm out there. It was one would think that there wasn't going to be a storm, and all of a sudden there it was. It was upon us.
Lee Carl in St. Thomas, and before him Gary Twominen in Puerto Rico. In Havana today, the Cuban President Fidel Castro opened the Ibero-American summit with a call on other Latin American countries to unite to protect their independence from the U.S. Dr. Castro made it clear that Cuba would not abandon communism, despite calls for democratic change from some attending the summit. The Spanish Prime Minister, José María Aznar, made strong comments in support of democratic change. Tom Gibb has been listening to some of the exchanges.
Fidel Castro recalled how when the Ibero-American summit started 9 years ago, he felt like the black sheep of the family. Everyone was then predicting, he said, his imminent fall in the wake of the Soviet collapse. The Cuban leader told how many undertook what he called the impossible mission of persuading Cuba that it should abandon the path of revolution and socialism. Castro said he listened with the half-smile of Mona Lisa and the biblical patience of Job, and determined to carry on struggling. At most of the summit since, the Cuban leader has again had to listen to a great deal of talk about democracy. This one is no exception. The Spanish king, Juan Carlos, called for authentic democracy and scrupulous respect for human rights before toasting President Castro at a dinner. His lead is being emulated by others today in the closed-door session of the summit. 8 of the 21 visiting delegations have also made a point of meeting with dissidents, who Fidel Castro accuses of being U.S.-paid traitors. However, none of the language being used by the visiting leaders is strong enough to cause offense. Indeed, at previous summits, the Cuban leader has signed declarations committing himself to democracy and political pluralism. He argues that his one-party state is more democratic than Western models. and the advantages of holding the summit in Havana are enormous. The image of President Castro acting as friendly host to 18 heads of state is, Cuban officials say, powerful support against U.S. attempts to isolate the island.
Tom Gibb reporting. In Geneva today, a small group of protesters accused the World Trade Organization of causing job losses because of its push for unrestricted free trade. Ken Richards has that story.
About 10 protesters of the group People's Global Action were able to access the roof of the WTO building from where they sought to make their point. Others chained themselves to the banister of the building's main stairway. Their anti-WTO banners were clear and unambiguous about how they felt. WTO kills people, one read. Another urged, kill the WTO. According to People's Global Action, the World Trade Organization is fostering a new wave of capitalist expansion and domination across the world. The demonstrators warn that they also plan to protest at the forthcoming WTO summit in Seattle, Washington. In Geneva today, they settled for denouncing globalization and tearing up World Trade Organization brochures they described as propaganda. Top U.S. official for Commerce and Agriculture Dan Glickman was in the building meeting with WTO Director General Mike Moore at the time of the protest.
Ken Richards reporting. You're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. Up to a tenth of expectant mothers in parts of rural Haiti are HIV positive. Overall figures also confirm that Haiti has the highest rate of HIV and AIDS infection in the Americas. It's the same for other infectious diseases like tuberculosis. Dr. Paul Farmer is a specialist in infectious diseases who works in rural Haiti and also teaches at the Harvard School of Medicine in Boston.
If you compare Haiti to a neighboring country such as Cuba or Jamaica, the comparison figures are sobering indeed. I mean, Haiti, for example, has the highest incidence of HIV in the Caribbean, whereas Cuba has the lowest. Haiti has, you know, the highest rates of maternal mortality. Cuba probably has the lowest. If you look at prevalence among people who live in slums in Port-au-Prince, women who come for prenatal care, who are not coming because they're sick with HIV, that up to 10% of them are found to be infected with HIV. That's lower than in many sub-Saharan African countries, but it's terrible. I mean, it's a frightfully high figure.
Dr. Farmer is in London as the guest of the Haiti Support Group, an organization set up to help Haitians in Haiti. He's done research on infections and inequalities, which further supports the notion that the poorest are more likely to have infectious diseases and less likely to have them treated.
Back in the 1980s, when Haiti was singled out as the birthplace of AIDS in the New World, in fact, that wasn't true at all. HIV came to Haiti from the United States, and if you looked at per capita rates at that time, what you could call attack rates, if you like, they were actually higher in some other countries. Now it is true, and because Haiti is the poorest of these countries, and since poverty and inequality are the primary cofactors in the advance of HIV, it's no wonder that Haiti is the most heavily burdened at this point. And not only is Haiti the poorest and most inegalitarian, probably, of countries in the Caribbean, it's also the one that's been most stricken by political problems, by political violence, by unrest. And so those have always been very powerful, again, cofactors for the spread of HIV. And that's true in parts of Africa where there have been war. And it's true in the Caribbean as well.
Does this inequality exist for the obvious reasons, like poorer people can't afford more medication, or is the imbalance more structural in terms of the attention that the global bodies pay to the problems?
For example, not only can people not afford treatments, some people are put at very high risk of acquiring these diseases, and some people are shielded from risk. So not only are they unable to acquire often the medications that could treat and cure them, they're also exposed through structural reasons, as you suggest, to much, much heightened risk.
Paul Farmer, Haitian-based specialist on infectious diseases. Almost 200,000 people were deported from the U.S. for criminal offenses during the 1999 fiscal year. Jamaica headed the list of CARICOM countries with almost 2,000. Leslie Goff has the story.
A new report by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service shows that more than a half of all of those deported or sent back to their home countries had been convicted on drug charges. Most of the others had been convicted of assault, burglary, or violating immigration laws. Mexico was, as last year, the country with the most deportees. But as Immigration and Naturalization spokeswoman Karen Kraushaar explains, several Caribbean nations, such as Jamaica, which came seventh on the deportations list, were also in the top rankings.
Of the 1,984 Jamaicans that we removed, 1,342 of those were criminals, 642 were non-criminals. Haiti is on the list. We deported exactly 431 Haitians. There were 304 Trinidadians and Tobagans deported or removed over the last year. And now the obligation for these returning aliens, criminal or otherwise, does fall into the hands of their home countries.
U.S. immigration authorities said the increase in deportations was the result in part of the success of their efforts to identify criminals who are not citizens while they're serving their prison sentences. Nearly 20,000 people were deported directly from state and federal prisons in the last year, an increase of 45%. The BBC Caribbean Report, this is Leslie Goff in New York.
The proportion of high school graduates in the English-speaking Caribbean who go on to university is much lower than the rest of the Americas. That's the finding of Hilary Beckles, a professor of history at UWE. He argues that this low rate of progression is holding up development.
Most countries are now still trying to put in place a process of compulsory, enforced secondary education, so that only a few areas have been able to make significant headway in the area of tertiary education.
So as a culture to leave school, to end your formal schooling after high school?
Well, that has been the tradition here, and it has only been broken in a few societies where there is now almost a natural tendency to move to tertiary education. I would say primarily in places like Barbados this has happened. But outside of Barbados, especially in the Windward and Leeward Islands, we are still trying to fix the matters of primary and secondary, and this is really quite disastrous for us.
What figures do you have at the high end there as well as at the low end?
Close to 25% of the age cohort in Barbados is in tertiary, and that this is close to the Latin American norm, which is about 30% right now. The North American norm is 55-60 and rising.
Give specific examples, Professor Beckles, of the ways in which Caribbean countries are being stifled in their development by not turning out a higher proportion, of people educated to the tertiary level.
Many of the large corporations in the region, many of the very profitable corporations in the region, depend heavily upon imported skills at the level of management, at the level of effective planning, strategic development, and consulting. So again, we see that we're witnessing a major importation of skilled professional labor into this region, in a region that is suffering indeed from significant unemployment. We have close to a hardcore of 28% unemployment in this region, and yet we import skilled labor, managerial labor, management labor, and all of the other areas in information technology and so on.
Another factor, Dr. Beckles, is the number of university places available against the potential university population. It is also significantly lower in the Caribbean than it is in the United States, where state and other colleges take in even less than gifted students.
Well, this is really absolutely true, and this is the predicament that we are faced with in the University of the West Indies, which has been the main vehicle at the upper end of the tertiary sector. We are now registering quite close to 20,000 students in the UWI system. But we are looking at a region in the English-speaking area, we are looking at close to 6-7 million people. So that, you know, the 20,000, and even when you put that alongside those who are registered in the other tertiary sectors, the community colleges and the newly formed University of Technology here in Jamaica, it is still really quite low. In fact, It is less than 5%. Those moving from secondary on to tertiary university is less than 5%. And that, of course, is not acceptable.
Professor Hilary Beckles, ending BBC Caribbean Report. This is Orin Gordon saying goodbye.